Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast. And as a special treat, I'd just like to get this guy to sing us in.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? Please, won't you be my neighbor?
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, the title gives it away. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the bits and bobs, really, that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover in this podcast have more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're certainly films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema, of the fact it's really difficult to get films made, and I want to salute those who managed to do so. Without further ado, I'm going to just crack on then with the first of the two films I'm doing in this episode of Film Stories. As always, I'm going to play you a clip to start with, and I'll come to the story, the other side of this.
Nick Dunn, you're probably the most hated man in America right now. Did you kill your wife, Nick?
Everyone told us and told us marriage is hard work. Not for me and Nick.
As you all know, my wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, disappeared 3 days ago. I had nothing to do with the disappearance of my wife. I have nothing to hide.
Has Amy got friends we can talk to?
No, not really.
You don't know if she has friends, you don't know what she does all day, and you don't know your wife's blood type.
Just being a good guy, so everybody can see him being a good guy.
Well, you really don't like him, do you?
All I'm trying to do is be nice to the people who are volunteering to help find Amy.
See, I've been away on this podcast summer break, and my abrupt editing skills are still absolutely top-notch, I'm sure you'll agree. That is a clip from the trailer of 2014's Gone Girl, directed by David Fincher, screenplay by Gillian Flynn, based on her book, and starring Ben Affleck, Rosamund Pike, Neil Patrick Harris, Tyler Perry and Carrie Coon are the main leads in this particular movie. And so the story of Gone Girl, well, a publishing sensation, really, it goes back to the start of the 2010s. But even before we get to the book, let's just have a quick chat about Reese Witherspoon, the Oscar-winning actor, and moving at this stage in her career, she moved into producing as well. And she was a woman on a mission because fed up with the dearth of quality female female leading roles in films and also an avid reader, she decided to make a firmer jump into film production. That she'd had a production company before, but that had been primarily to develop projects for her to star in. But this time she had a broader plan, that she wanted now to develop projects for women to star in across film and television. And this led to the creation of a production company, Pacific Standard, that she set up in partnership with Bruna Papandera. Now, amongst the first two manuscripts that Pacific Standard took receipt of, one was Wild, the other was Gone Girl, and they happened to be the first two projects that this particular company optioned to press ahead to make into films. Now, in the case of Gone Girl, Papandera got wind of the book at the end of 2011 when it hadn't been published. It was still in manuscript form, but it's pretty well known around Hollywood that manuscripts do get passed around and early buzz on projects just bubbles up and bidding wars take place before a book has even made it to a bookstore. That was certainly what was going to happen here. But in the case of Witherspoon and Papandera, because they jumped in early, they were able to get their option in and get their option in place. Now, Gone Girl was the work and is the work of author Gillian Flynn. This was her third novel off the top of my head, and the manuscript had been doing the rounds. Hollywood was interested, and when the book was published in 2012, it swiftly became Flynn's biggest hit to date. In fact, it became an absolute publishing sensation. But by that stage, the Hollywood deal making was already well underway, because now it was a case of, well, which movie studio wants to pick this project up? And Flynn was fielding calls from pretty much all of them. Now, she knew that her story had jagged edges to it, that it wasn't necessarily a particularly Hollywood story. Maybe in the 1980s and early 90s when R-rated thrillers were more of a thing. But this was going to be a slightly tougher sell going into the early 2010s, the mid-2010s. But also she was aware that she'd written, what, a 500-page book. And as an avid reader of film screenplays already, she knew that was going to have to come down by, what, roughly around 2/3 to make a film script. However, this was her chance. And as she told the Los Angeles Times, I mean, she said it was a big, dense book. She says, you think you can drop a certain scene and then you realise three scenes later you've just missed an important setup. And she said, my big fear was having it turn into this kind of an engine and losing what I thought was special about it, the smaller nuances and the humour of it. And so with that in mind, she was determined to have a go at adapting this herself. And she certainly had the power and clout in her deal making to be able to do so. And so within 2 months of the film's of the book's debut, 20th Century Fox had optioned the book formally and was looking to back the project with Witherspoon and her company producing. But written into Flynn's deal was that she would get to write her draft of the screenplay before anyone else was given an opportunity to do so. What she didn't want was a studio coming in, assigning a writer, and she was cut out of the process. She wanted at the very least to have first go at this, and Fox, very keen to secure the project, sort of gave it the nod. Now, she didn't go into this naively. She knew that adaptation was a tricky business, and so she did her research. As well as being the aforementioned avid reader of screenplays, she looked at how certain books had been adapted to the screen. She looked at Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley, how the film of that turned out, for instance. She also got in touch with Steve Kloves, who'd had the mammoth job at adapting the majority of the Harry Potter books to the big screen, and talked to him about how exactly do you go about doing this. And then to refresh her memory of the book that she'd written herself, she listened to the audiobook of Gone Girl. Now, she was doing the tour promoting the novel while all this was going on, but there came a point during her writing process where she stopped allowing herself to go back to her novel. She stopped listening to that audiobook, and she would write the script based on her recollection of it rather than slavishly devoting herself back to her original text. She duly did her drafts. The first draft, as she would tell Fast Company in an interview, was basically TV miniseries length, but she drew it down, and by December 2012, she got to a point where she could deliver a screenplay draft to 20th Century Fox. Now, separately, director David Fincher was circling at this stage in his career. He was coming off the back of relative success with his US remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I say relative success. It did well for an R-rated movie, but it also raised questions at that stage in the US about the box office potential of an R-rated movie. Those conversations were duly smashed a few years down the line by Deadpool coming along. But at that stage, it was still a thing. Now, Fincher was intrigued by the idea of turning Gone Girl into a film, and in early 2013, Gillian Flynn and David Fincher met up for the first time to talk about this. Now, Flynn, a movie nerd, wanted David Fincher to do it. Why wouldn't she? In 2010, he'd made one of his finest films, The Social Network. He's coming off things like Fight Club. I mean, David Fincher needs no introduction, short of the fact I will get to Zodiac on this podcast in due course. I think Zodiac is possibly his masterpiece, although there's some competition in there. But the bottom line for this story is Flynn wanted Fincher to do the film, but she didn't assume that he would want to do it. Now, on the other side of the table, Fincher was not really that keen with the idea of joining forces with a first-time screenwriter. However, as they conversed, it became clear that they saw the same things in the book, that they saw the things from the book that they wanted to make it into the movie. And they got on and they were getting somewhere. Now, they were both busy. I mean, Fincher at this stage was in the midst of the TV show House of Cards that was being made and developed for Netflix, developing material as well. And so Flynn would go away and write, and she would send material over to David Fincher. Fincher would then read it. They'd then have a phone chat, and Flynn would rework. And Flynn, she said she enjoyed the process. She certainly enjoyed this part of the process working with Fincher. She would describe him as, quote, a really good editor. Now, it became clear that David Fincher was going to direct this. He was putting the hours in. He would sign ultimately on the dotted line to do so. And that would have a knock-on effect where Reese Witherspoon was concerned. Effectively, as the originator of the movie project, she was looking to play the lead role of Amy in the film as well. But as she told The Hollywood Reporter a few years down the line, she said, "I was always open to doing it. But whenever David Fincher says he wants to do a project, you just sit back and say, whatever you want to do." And Witherspoon said, "We had a long conversation where he was like, you're not right for it and this is why." And she would say, "I actually completely agreed with him." So who was going to be right? I mean, there were two difficult roles to cast at the heart of this, Amy and her husband, Nick. And so casting-wise, I mean, Ben Affleck at this stage was on the verge of directing his latest movie, Live by Night. I mean, he picked up his latest Oscars for his film Argo at this stage and was planning to direct again. But Fincher had been exploring possible candidates to play the role of Nick. I mean, Affleck at this stage had been cast as Batman as well. So that was the direction his career was heading towards. But he saw in still images facial mannerisms in Affleck that he just thought they'd just be right for this particular role. And so he got in touch, they had conversations, and Affleck in the end agreed to sign on the dotted line. He would delay directing Live by Night to be able to do Gone Girl. But Fincher would say in interviews, certainly promoting the film, that one of the reasons he was drawn to Affleck says he knows what it's like to be hunted. Affleck had been in the lens of the paparazzi, in the lens of tabloid press for a long time, and he knew part of that life, and he knew that that was where this character was going to go. Now, it's worth noting as well, and IndieWire reported on this, that John Hamm had been rumoured at one stage to be taking on the role of Nick. The New York Post also reported this, saying that he was up for the lead role, but he was in the midst of doing the TV show Mad Men at the time, and Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, was allegedly said to have blocked his chance to be able to take the lead in Gone Girl. That an anonymous source said Matt would not let John out of his contract to do it. John was really upset at the time and is still upset because he's thinking about the future of his career as Mad Men comes to a close. However, Hamm just pressed ahead with his Mad Men work. He's not done too shabbily when it comes to films either. And the path was clear for Affleck to take this one. But the role of Amy was equally crucial. And, you know, the several names were being bandied around. Emily Blunt, Charlize Theron, Natalie Portman, terrific actors, all among the candidates. But what Fincher was looking for was someone one of the qualities he was looking for was someone where you couldn't immediately age them. You couldn't necessarily say, I know how old that person is, that there was a degree of ambiguity to them. And so while Rosamund Pike, who'd broken through with the James Bond film Die Another Day many, many years before, was wasn't the immediate choice for this one. At least certainly in the eyes of the Hollywood trade press, she was actually the one that Fincher was zeroing in on. Not that Rosamund Pike really knew this. Now, the first she knew was when she got a call saying David Fincher wants to meet you for a project. And so she took the call. I mean, why wouldn't you? She didn't know it was for Gone Girl at that point. In fact, she hadn't read the book at this stage when Fincher talked to her. And she didn't quite know what to make of it all. Then she realised what it was for. She was told what it was for. And so it started a series of conversations that took place over Skype over a short period of time. Now, it needed to be over Skype because Fincher was in America and Pike was in the middle of shooting a British film called What We Did on Our Holiday, which is sort of spun out of the TV series Outnumbered. And she was taking on a lead role with that, shooting it in Scotland, but not necessarily near where she could get a stable internet connection or in the place where she was stopping. So what she had to do was join, apparently, and this came out in a Vanity Fair piece, a gym near the location in Scotland, just so she could get an internet connection, so she could toddle off there to go and talk to Fincher. And Fincher and Pike would converse as she made her way more and more through the book. They'd talk about how far she got through the book, what she was feeling, and it all led up to an invitation to go across to America, to St. Louis. Now, this was where Fincher was scouting locations for the film, and the pair met up, had a conversation, and it came out in W magazine that Pike, off the back of that meeting, went back to Scotland to finish making What We Did on Our Holiday, and she got a text message that she, the text message from Fincher said, "You have the part." Just ahead of her, Ben Affleck had been announced, and the news broke in July of 2013 that Rosamund Pike and Ben Affleck were going to star. At that stage, Neil Patrick Harris and Tyler Perry were also linked. Perry, in fact, would sign up with apparently his agent hiding information about the film and the director and the book from him, because otherwise it might spook him to the point of not taking the work on. Patrick Fugit, Carrie Coon and Kim Dickens were also confirmed in September. And on September the 11th, 2013, some early filming work began ahead of the formal start of production on Gone Girl on September the 15th, 2013. Now, I've talked about one or two David Fincher movies on this podcast before, and I think most film nerds know that he's very, very precise in the way that he goes about making his movies. He has an ethos of, if you're going to get all the equipment and pay all that expense to get cameras out, to get people out, to get a load of production crew out, you may as well be filming as much as possible. You don't want people hanging around in trailers when you can have them on set, when you can be trying things. The bottom line is, he does an awful lot of takes, an awful lot of takes. He also likes things to be pretty exact, and he would run scenes on Gone Girl as he would on his previous films time after time after time after time. He would shoot a lot of material, but also he would get a lot of material in the can in a given day, that he would get 4 or 5 hours a day of footage shot. And in fact, it was Carrie Coon who captured this talking to Collider, where she talked about his process. She said, "What I discovered about David is he's a perfectionist and I'm a perfectionist. So if you want to do 70 takes, that's all the more time I have to practice and try to do better." She would say he would show me the frame and tell me why he was asking me to do the things he was asking for. And she argued, you can't take it personally because he's looking at the whole picture. You know when he's focused on you, and so many other times he's not. And if you take that personally, you're going to get in your own way. And this was his process. In fact, there was a point where Rosamund Pike had to fly back to the UK just to do a couple of pickup shots for What We Did on Our Holiday. And she told this to Kermit O'Mayo's radio program that she came and did those pickup shots. She just did a couple of takes and turned to the directors and just said, "Is that all you want? I'm working with David Fincher at the moment." Turned out that was all they wanted, and she flew back to the US to the days of doing 30, 40 takes of certain shots. Now, one of the most bizarre film stories that came up in the midst of shooting Gone Girl was over a cap, in particular a cap that David Fincher wanted Ben Affleck to wear. That there was a spat of sorts between the pair, although I suspect this is one of those where it was heavily blown up by the media and there wasn't actually too much to it. But let's do some sports stuff. So Ben Affleck is a fan of the Boston Red Sox. David Fincher insisted that the character of Nick would wear a New York Yankees hat. Now, I am from the UK. I'm not familiar with how fervent the rivalry is between the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees. But let's just say Affleck told the New York Times, he said, David, I love you. I would do anything for you, but I will not wear a Yankees hat. I just can't. I can't wear it because it's going to become a thing. I will never hear the end of it. I can't do it. And Affleck refused to wear the cap. Now, if you believe the clickbait version of the story, this shut the film down for days. This was a disaster. This was a mass falling out. Actually, what happened was they had a chat. Affleck did say, I can't wear it. And he said there was, and he said that they had a conversation between them. And the compromise was that Affleck would wear a New York Mets cap instead. So there you go. That's slightly less clickbaity, but a little bit close to the truth of what actually happened. And that's the cap you see him wearing in the movie. Production would carry on. I mean, it's very efficient, a very efficient filming, even though it was doing, what, up to about 50 takes per scene in the vast majority of cases. But Fincher was working on, what, about 100-day production schedule. He's working to a $60 million budget. So as he said in the past, it's just like he'd rather not spend the money on helicopters. He'd rather spend the money on shooting footage. And that's what he was doing. So it's relatively modestly costed film, given the high profile of the talent involved, in fact, the high profile of the project itself. By the turn of 2014, filming had wrapped up with somewhat 400-500 hours for Fincher and his team to wade through. We knew by this stage as well that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who'd done such staggering work on the music for films like The Social Network, were coming back and reuniting with Fincher for this one. In fact, Reznor would note in an interview that the film was already a lot darker than he was expecting and a bit nasty, and he was expecting dark and nasty, but not quite this dark and nasty. Now, there was a pre-existing fan base for Gone Girl, that the film, that the book itself had sold tens of millions of copies, and as such, fans of the book were protective of where the film was going. So it didn't necessarily help, or did it, depending on your viewpoint, that in an interview in January 2014, David Fincher told Entertainment Weekly magazine that Flynn had scrapped the original ending of the book and, quote, started from scratch. Now, Flynn would go online and dial back from that in a further interview, but as an Entertainment Weekly piece close to the release of the film noted, since he'd said that, he's had to contend with fan outrage over that comment. Now, Fincher said that Entertainment Weekly took his quote out of context, the magazine disagreed, but they had a conversation. What exactly had changed? And as Fincher told the outlet, everything and nothing. Which wasn't particularly helpful. He said, you're not changing the marrow of the creature, you're just changing the bone structure and the muscles and the skin and the hair. He said, it's all of its outer sheathing, but at its core, it's exactly what I think Gillian always intended. So, as you can imagine, that did absolutely zero to quash rumours that the ending had been dramatically changed. And in fact, it may as well have just gone to the local fuel station, got a couple of gallons of unleaded and just poured that on the particular flame. The interest in the film bubbled. I mean, the first trailer for it was hugely, hugely anticipated and widely watched as well. And Fox, with some confidence, was building towards a release date for this one in October 2014 in the US, premiering the movie at the New York Film Festival on September the 26th, 2014. The promotion in tandem with all of this was building up, and as soon as a set picture appeared online, it was devoured. As soon as any little tidbit about the production came about, it was also devoured. And then, of course, the first trailer for the movie landed. Now, this went online in April of 2014. In fact, I'm reading the Guardian article on it now. It's like, Gone Girl's trailer is out, but is Fincher on form? And there was thinking, is this going to be a grown-up thriller? Is this the kind of thriller that Hollywood had but almost forgotten how to make, really, outside of things like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? The first trailer that came out stripped right back on dialogue as well, played heavily on the imagery, and the response to it was strong. It certainly did nothing to douse any kind of enthusiasm in the movie, and so it was full steam ahead, really, for the release of the film. So there were a couple of reasons this was highly anticipated, of course. One of which was it was Gone Girl. It was based on this hugely loved book, this hugely successful book. Also, it's a new David Fincher film. And little did we know at that stage, it was going to be the last David Fincher film for over half a decade as well. And so when it got in front of critics, I mean, generally, they were very strong. I mean, in particular, Rosamund Pike's performance was given a very, very strong thumbs up. Ben Affleck came out of it well as well. I mean, whilst he was shooting Gone Girl, he was in the midst of working around the world of Batman as well. He was juggling an awful lot in his personal life, which I'm not going to go into now. And this was a 2.5-hour thriller that had no plans whatsoever to tailor itself to a PG-13 family-friendly audience. And the feeling was that as much as it had cut out certain elements of the book and certain characters of the book, that I because Flynn had made those decisions herself, that it wasn't foisted on her by screenwriters coming in and changing her work, I think that certainly helped. But also it was felt that they got to the core of the text, that it was working, that it was a different beast from the book, but also a familiar enough one to just about get away with pleasing the vast majority of people. In fact, a large swathe of high-profile critics as well would put it in their top 10 lists for the end of the year. They wouldn't necessarily put it in first place, but it was certainly in and around there. But the question mark remained, would the audience turn out to watch it? I mean, there was still an element of gamble to this. And so it went into US cinemas in October of 2014. And the response to it, well, it was strong. Much to the relief of executives at Fox, it opened in first place with a 37.5 million opening weekend, the weekend of October the 3rd to the 5th. This was a great result. I mean, no two ways about it. Not least because there was strong competition that weekend as well with the opening of the horror spin-off movie Annabelle, which also opened with $37 million. Gone Girl just edged that out into first place. But the competition around wasn't bad either. We weren't quite at the stage where October had become an annex of prime blockbuster release time, although Guardians of the Galaxy's presence in the top 10, and that was one of the transformative films into making late summer blockbuster territory. The fact that Guardians of the Galaxy was there was just an indicator of what was to come. But still, Denzel Washington in The Equalizer was in third place, the previous week's number one, and helped itself to 18.7 million in its second weekend as well. Laika's lovely, wonderful The Box Trolls was in the top 10. The first Maze Runner movie was in there, and that was doing well too. This Is Where I Leave You, Dolphin Tale 2, and No Good Deed were the films that rounded out the top 10 as well. And Gone Girl also held its audience for its second week too. That there's a school of thought that big films, certainly big hyped films without an awful lot of substance behind them, sometimes with substance behind them, will lose 50, 60, 70% of their weekend gross going into their second weekend. In the case of Gone Girl, it lost 30%. It held number one spot for a second week with 26 million in the bank, holding off the likes of Dracula Untold. And in fact, it was the film Fury, quite an underrated film, that one, I think, starring Brad Pitt, directed by David Ayers, which knocked it off the top spot the week after, and with a 23 million gross. Gone Girl was still making 17 million by its third weekend. And in fact, by the time it left US cinemas, it was a really sizable hit, $167 million. At the US box office, and it was also a hit that travelled overseas as well, 201 million outside of the US for a worldwide gross of 369 million. No wonder Gillian Flynn was being asked about a sequel to the film, and she didn't play that down either. She said she would certainly be interested in revisiting the characters at some point, telling the New York Daily News. She said there could be a sequel at some point if everyone's game to get the gang back together. It could be really fun a few years from now to pick it up and see what those crazy duns are up to a few years down the road, and if they got on well, not well, I don't think. But she said, I would have to have exactly the same people back to do it. She would want Rosamund Pike, Ben Affleck, David Fincher, and they basically haven't come back to do it. I don't think that's a massive spoiler to tell you that. Flynn and Fincher would look to work together again, though, that they would quickly sign up to work on the US remake of the British TV success Utopia by the time that ultimately made it to screen scenes. Fincher had long dropped away from that, but Flynn stayed with that right the way through to its release. And it's also worth noting that Gone Girl interested the Academy Awards as well, though perhaps not to the degree that some were expecting. Nonetheless, for the 87th Academy Awards, Rosamund Pike was nominated for Best Actress. She didn't win, as it happened. The prize that year went to Julianne Moore in the film Still Alice. But Gone Girl, surprisingly, was shut out of every other category. And this was at a point where the Academy had opened up the Best Picture race to lots and lots of films rather than just five. It's a reasonably strong field, but it was perhaps a surprise that Gone Girl didn't make more of an appearance. But still, for Reese Witherspoon, I mean, there would be some compensation by the fact that the other project she'd optioned at the same time, That Would Be Wild, that had turned up at the Oscars as well. In fact, Reese Witherspoon would also get a Best Actress Oscar nomination that year for playing the lead in Wild, and Laura Dern would get a Best Supporting Actress nod as well. That took two nominations to Gone Girl's one. But both films were successes, and in fact Witherspoon went on to sell her company and start a much bigger venture called Hello Sunshine that she's working on to this day. She continues to develop projects for women to star in that are enjoying a lot of mainstream success as well. In the case of Gone Girl, I mean, the aftermath for David Fincher would be, it would be a long, long time before he would get a film, as I said, off the ground again. And that's the shame, really, that I'm a big fan of Gone Girl. I think it's a film that very much rewards repeated viewing, and it wouldn't be until Netflix came along with its checkbook that Fincher would be tempted away from the television projects he'd been working on, House of Cards, Mindhunter, and go back to directing for a film with the movie Mank that was written by his late father. He's got more projects on the stove at the moment, and if all goes to plan, if I'm still here in many years' time, we'll talk about those in future episodes of Film Stories. But that brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of the podcast. And so I'm just going to do my parish notices and pleas and requests and nice things. So first and foremost, if you like this podcast, there are three ways to support it. I'm so grateful to those of you who do so. It is hugely appreciated. I'm grateful for you listening, to be fair. So, you know, everyone's a winner, right? But if you want to financially support what I'm trying to do with Film Stories, which includes giving lots of writers their first paid writing work as well, which includes investing in materials for this podcast, which doesn't cover the coffee bill, sadly, but that's quite expensive. You can find me on Patreon, patreon.com/SimonBrew. And if you back me financially there and back this podcast and the website financially there, you get the podcast early. In this particular case, you'd have got this episode very early, I think. You'll also find out the gossip of what we're up to and behind the scenes stuff on Film Stories as well. If you can subscribe to this podcast at your podcast home of choice, my podcast host is changing, so hopefully it all still works, then that's hugely appreciated as well. And likewise, if you can leave ideally a hugely positive review, that makes a difference. That really helps with algorithms and posh things that I don't really understand. Film Stories is also print magazines that have spun out of this podcast. We've got Film Stories, which is our monthly magazine we publish here in the UK. The latest issue of that is on sale now. And we're working on issue 11 of Film Junior as well, which is a print magazine for under 15s. A lot of it written by under 15s as well. We're really proud of both of those. If you'd like copies, go to store.filmstories.co.uk. We ship them all over the world. But without further ado, I'm going to get on to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of the podcast, and it's another fairly recent one. Let me take you back to 2019. I'll play you a clip. Come to the story, the other side of this.
Mr. Rogers,
I'm here to interview you.
It is so nice to meet you.
You okay?
Profiling Mr. Rogers.
Lloyd, please don't ruin my childhood.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
We are trying to give the world positive ways of dealing with their feelings.
Yeah? Like what?
There are many things you can do. You can play all the lowest keys on a piano at the same time.
Love broken people like me.
Sometimes we have to ask for help, and that's okay.
And what you've got there is a clip from the trailer of 2019's A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood, directed by Marielle Heller, written by Mika Fitzsim and Blue and Noah Harpster, and based on the article Can You Say Hero by Tom Gennard. And the film stars Tom Hanks, Matthew Rhys, Susan Kelechi-Watson and Chris Cooper. Now, we've got to dial back to Fred Rogers. Now, for those of you who listen in America, he needs no introduction. A legend of American children's television, a public service broadcasting in America. I've watched lots of YouTube material of Fred Rogers, and we never had him in the UK. That we were never given the chance to see his incredible work, which spanned decades of teaching children about kindness, about talking about things that are actually affecting them. And so by the time there was word of a possible film coming, I must admit, I was watching from the outside, not quite sure who he was. But for writer Tom Gennard in the US, he knew who he was when he was assigned a profile piece of him for Esquire magazine in 1998. But he found himself, as the story goes, a little bit reluctant. Was this really someone who would warrant a big profile piece? That Rogers was fairly protective in interviews. He's happy to talk, but wouldn't give an awful lot of himself away. And so apparently he wasn't that keen on the assignment, but came away from interviewing Fred Rogers utterly transformed, and his piece was really quite something. And in fact, Tom Gennard and Fred Rogers would remain friends until Rogers' death in the early 2000s, but still we're a little way away from a film of Fred Rogers' life coming together, because Rogers' estate was very, very understandably protective of his work and his name, and so the idea of doing any kind of straight biopic of Fred Rogers was going to be a no-no. However, there was a spark that hit a pair of writers in 2010, and those writers are Noah Harpster and Mika Fitzsim and Blue. At this stage, they were some way away from getting their break into Hollywood. They would go on to work on projects such as Maleficent Mistress of Evil and Transparent as well for Amazon. But at this stage, they were still looking for their break. That they hadn't had a screen credit at this point, but the moment that would change things and start a 10-year journey to bring the film A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood to the screen was Harpster's Toddler, that Noah Harpster sat down and watched old episodes of Mr. Rogers' Neighbourhood with his toddler and thought there might be something in this. But they weren't sure when they were talking about it quite what the angle was. That's talking about it, not Harpster and Toddler. It was Harpster and his writing partner, Mika Fitzsim and Blue. And so what they didn't want to do was a conventional biopic. Not that they'd be able to do one anyway of this particular subject, but they still thought there was something in the Fred Rogers story. And so they set about researching, and they read up lots and lots and lots. And eventually they found Tim Madigan's book, published in 2013, called I'm Proud of You, My Friendship with Mr. Rogers. And that was their way in, a story not directly of Fred Rogers' life, but of how Fred Rogers had altered someone else's for the better. So Tim Madigan's book was an autobiographical novel, and the logline that would appear would be a journalist looking for a story about television's role in the Columbine tragedy in the US interviews TV's Mr. Rogers, and as a friendship develops between the two, he finds himself confronting his own issues at home. And that was the logline for what would become the film script, I'm Proud of You, taking its name from the book as well, that Harpster and Fitzsim and Blue would write, and it would turn up on the 2013 Black list of the best unproduced screenplays. So if you're unfamiliar with this, Hollywood agents and people with far more power than me, there's an annual poll as to which are the best scripts that you've seen that haven't yet been made into movies. That's published as the Blacklist, and lots of films turn up on the Blacklist, go on to be made. I mean, Argo, I talked about earlier in this episode, was certainly one of those. And so I'm Proud of You sat on there. But there was a reason they couldn't make this Fred Rogers film, because they had Harpster and Fitzsim and Blue did not have the life rights to Rogers' story to bring it to the screen. And as I mentioned, his estate was very guarded about it. And in fact, it was the Hollywood Reporter who reported the story of Bill Eisler, who was the former president and the CEO of the Fred Rogers Company. And he told the writers, he said, you seem like nice guys, and I'm glad to hear anything you have to say, but there will never, ever be a Fred Rogers movie. And that's what the two writers were working against, even as they were getting projects off the ground in Hollywood and getting screen credits. But they didn't give up. And eventually they began to wear Isla down. And as they said, I think he responded to our intentions that we weren't looking to glamorize Fred. We were just looking to tell this story about Fred changing the life of a person in his world. But the script based on Tim Madigan's book wasn't quite working. I mean, it had gone to people like Tom Hanks, and Tom Hanks had turned it down, and it wasn't catching fire. And so they kept digging. And once they got the Fred Rogers estate on board, they could go and look through Rogers's archive of materials. And that is where they struck gold, because among the effects of Fred Rogers was a box that was labelled Tom Junnard. And inside that box were hundreds of the letters that the pair had sent each other. And what the two screenwriters found was the relationship between the two that had developed since they'd done that profile. And so they just thought, this is the story. This is it. And Joanne Rogers, Fred's widow, granted them the rights to pursue a story based on that, granted Fred Rogers his life rights for their script. And so they started work again. And in late 2014, this is where we bring Junnard back into the story, because he would tell The Atlantic that it was at the end of 2014, I heard from two screenwriters, Noah Harpster and Mika Fitzman-Blue, who were interested in using my Squire story as the basis of a movie based on in and around the life of Fred Rogers. And so Junnard agreed. I mean, he didn't think anything particularly would come of this, but he signed the rights over to that story. And so there they had the life rights. Now they had the rights to the article, and they could start to build a fresh script. So just putting those two to the side for a minute, let's move on to 2015, and let's move on to director Marielle Heller, who is slowly starting to make her way into filmmaking, having broken through with her film Diary of a Teenage Girl. This is a terrific film. And if you've never seen it, it hit trouble in the UK because the British Board of Film Classification gave it the kind of certificate that meant the people it was targeting at and who could benefit from it weren't able to see it. But the reputation of the film, whilst it's not fully taken off, deservedly continues to grow, and I do urge you to seek it out. It's a marvellous film. I remember here in the UK that there was a PR genius, Sheena Patel, who we lost a few years ago, who banged the drum so hard for that film, was ringing journalists up to get them to watch it, and she was right. And Sheena, this episode goes out to you as always. But Marielle Heller was friends with Colin Hanks. Colin Hanks is the son of Tom Hanks, and was at Colin Hanks's house and met Tom Hanks, and they started talking. And Tom would, as the Hollywood Reporter also added, seek out a copy off the back of this conversation of Diary of a Teenage Girl, and he'd sit and watch it and was impressed. Heller, meanwhile, would go on to work on her next project, which I'll come to shortly. But by going back to A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood, by 2016, a new draft of the script had been put together that brought Junnard's story into it. And he was in Florida when he got a phone call out of the blue from Mika Fitzman-Blue about the Mr. Rogers movie. And he said in this phone call, Noah and I finished a draft of our script. We're very happy with it. And they wanted to send it to the man who'd written the profile piece and the man who was now part of the film that they'd written. However, there was a twist, and they needed to get Junnard's sign off on it because they'd fictionalised part of his life, because they got the core going and writing the profile and the relationship between the two in there. But also they made up a relationship between Junnard and his father and his wife and wrote that version of the film. And so Junnard would tell The Atlantic, he said, I read a copy of the script over the weekend with an open mind. And on Monday morning, I wrote Mika and Noah back, along with Peter Saraf, the producer who was behind the film and the company that had optioned the Squire story. And his request was to change his name and the names of his family members. And so that's how his name was no longer a character in the film, and it would become Lloyd Vogel instead. Now, by the time the film actually came to shoot and Junnard would go along and see the film on location, he, as much as he would be sat looking at Lloyd Vogel, the Lloyd Vogel character was drawn on his clothes, drawn on his mannerisms, and so there was a familiarity there which he wasn't objecting to. He just found that really quite a moment, I think. But as much at this stage in the story, in 2016, with the name change in place, I mean, he had one or two niggles by the sounds of it, but he liked the script, but he reconciled in his head, it's not going to get made anyway, so off you trot, go on, do your worst. However, unbeknownst to him, other wheels were in motion, because Marielle Heller was away working on her next film, which was Can You Ever Forgive Me? This, again, a terrific movie, would earn Oscar nominations for Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant, with Richard E. Grant being one of the most memorable Oscar nominees of recent times. His Twitter feed, as he enjoyed that whole process, was really something else. But again, this sent Heller up the Hollywood tree a little bit further. And meanwhile, while she was making that movie, Tom Hanks had been emailing her and saying, we need a project to work on. Is there something we can work on together? And so, where this crosses over with Mika Fitzsimmons Blue and Noah Harpster, well, Marielle Heller knew them because she'd worked on the TV series Transparent. She'd done some directing on that. And she knew that they were working on a Mr. Rogers project as well. Now, what she was also looking to do with her directorial career was make films with female protagonists. But then she got to see the Mr. Rogers script, and an exception was very quickly made. In fact, she would say that this is the only man she would make the exception for. And she was instantly in. By the summer of 2017, she was on board the movie, even though they didn't have an actor to play Mr. Rogers, and even though there was a very obvious candidate to play him. That obvious candidate was Tom Hanks, who by this stage in 2017 had already turned the film down 3 times. But Marielle Heller had a relationship with him. She knew him. And so she just said, let me give it one more try. And so the new draft of the script, which Hanks hadn't seen, was sent in his direction. And Heller also gave her pitch about, this is going to be an offbeat biopic. This isn't going to be a traditional biopic. I'm going to use miniatures. I'm going to do a miniature town. We're going to use puppets. We're going to do things that people aren't really doing with these films, as it happened. And Hanks went away, read the script, and was interested. And once Tom Hanks is interested in your project, it's no longer a project. It is a thing. And he needed to fit it into 2018 if he was going to make it. And this is what, towards the autumn of 2017 we're in at the moment. But all of a sudden, this film that had been pottering around, that turned up in a different guise on the blacklist years later, it had Hollywood royalty attached. This was clearly going to happen. It had a red-hot director in Marielle Heller. It had Tom Hanks starring. There was a slight stumbling block in that there was a 2018 documentary about Fred Rogers that was also being made called Won't You Be My Neighbor? And that generated a little bit of awards interest as well. In fact, Hanks and Heller would go to a screening of that and just have a conversation about just how does this impact our film. Sony, with Tom Hanks on board, was happy to back the Fred Rogers movie nonetheless, and put it was said at the time to be around $25 million budget behind it. Various tax breaks were used, but it was apparently around $30-40 million, depending on which source you believed. But still, it had Tom Hanks in it. It would look like, by the nature of the project, it would be a good one to get an awards run as well. And in January 2018, the announcement of the project came together. The film at that stage was called You Are My Friend. Tom Hanks was going to be Mr. Rogers. Marielle Heller was confirmed as director. The other core piece of casting was Matthew Rhys, who'd been enjoying success in the TV show The Americans. He would have to audition several times to land the role of Lloyd Vogel in the movie, but land the role he duly would. And so production could move ahead finally in September of 2018, with the shoot of the movie taking place. It was a fairly quick shoot as well, in Pittsburgh in the US. And they were painstaking about the recreation of Fred Rogers' TV show and TV studio that they were putting in their version of the film. In fact, the original WQED studio where Fred Rogers' program had been recorded was used to shoot large parts of A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And as Hanks would note, it was incredibly fast. He'd tell this to Deadline. He said 3 weeks of shooting in Pittsburgh just flew by. And he would say that's a testament to how much of an organized filmmaker Marielle was. And I mean, just in terms of authenticity as well, they brought in the same broadcast cameras that they used to shoot the TV shows for certain segments of the film, the same kind of monitors. And there was also a moment in the script which made it into the final take of the film where the movie is silent for 1 minute. And I don't want to particularly spoil this for those of you who've not seen it, but short of to say, this was a moment that caused some conversation. Can you have a silent moment of film where characters aren't talking? And Hanks would say, a minute is a really long time. He said, but it was in the script. And he said, the day we were supposed to shoot it, I said to Marielle, we're really going to do this. And she just looked at me and said, yes. Yes, we are. For Hanks, the challenge of playing Fred Rogers, apart from the risk of, well, to use internet cliche, ruining the childhood of those who'd grown up with him. No, I don't believe things ruin childhoods like that, but there we go. Well, this was a tricky character because people loved Fred Rogers, and also he had to capture him on screen. And one of the particular challenges that Hanks found in bringing Fred Rogers to the big screen was the speed at which he talked. That Hanks is naturally a relatively quick talker, and so the challenge he had was slowing down, that he had to keep Rogers' deliberately careful, slow speech, and Hanks had to match it. And this would prove quite a test for him. I mean, he would catch it on screen in the end, of course, but that was one of the bigger challenges that perhaps he didn't necessarily see coming at first. Still, on hand was Joanne Rogers, Fred's widow, who was a consultant on the film, who was involved in the film and utterly signed off on Tom Hanks's casting for the movie. And she helped Hanks capture her husband's representation, right down to lending him some of the ties that Fred Rogers wore and just helping him get it right, really. One other thing about the shoot of the film as well, Mariel Heller was said to have worked 10-hour days on this one, that she'd set a schedule in line with the ethos of Fred Rogers, whereby everyone could go home at the end of the day and see their kids. So they worked 10 hours through with no lunchtime, but it meant you were home at the end of the day while your kids were still awake. Filming wrapped up on the movie in November 2018. The announcement of the final name of the movie wasn't far behind, A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood. And Heller at this stage, who was in Oscar contention already for Can You Ever Forgive Me? Well, she had a bit of time to shape her final cut of this movie. Meanwhile, images of Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers were published online and were scrutinised with the degree of someone in a new Batman costume. Such is the affection that Fred Rogers is held. And the first full trailer for the movie would land in the summer of 2019. Again, similar levels of scrutiny. Now, no one was going into this thinking this was going to be a massive blockbuster film, but still, there was that sense that I mentioned before, that this was the kind of movie that had an awards run to it. And so the decision was made to premiere it at the Toronto International Film Festival in September 2019. There had been a plan to put it in cinemas in October 2019, but Sony would push that back towards the end of November of that year, prime award season too. And when it went before critics, well, this was a burst of kindness, of happiness, of just a really upbeat, lovely film. And while some critics found holes to punch in it, the performance of Tom Hanks was uniformly praised, as was the work of Matthew Rhys in the movie as well. And the feeling that was coming through, and I read quite a lot of American reviews, was that it done Mr. Rogers proud. But would audiences go out en masse to see it? And would this get quite a good awards run as well? Well, there was a little bit of crossover with Gone Girl in the answer to the latter question, but let's just have a look at the box office first, because it landed in American cinemas November the 22nd to the 24th, and opened in third place with $13 million to its name. It just held off 21 Bridges, which opened up in fourth with the late great Chadwick Boseman, of course. Ford versus Ferrari, or Le Mans 66, if you're in my part of the world, that had been number one the week before. That was down to number two. And the big opener that A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood was up against, well, that would be Frozen 2, which opened with 10 times as much money, $130 million. But still, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood had good reviews, had done decent box office, and its week-on-week drop was minuscule as well. It was down 11% the following week, as it stayed in the top five. It stayed in the top five for a couple of weeks in the end. And by the time A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood had completed its run in American cinemas, it had grossed $61.7 million, which perfectly respectable for effectively a biopic drama of a very American figure. Now, the fact that Mr. Rogers is and was a very American figure must have played a part in its muted box office returns outside of the US, just $6 million around the world. Those of us who did see it in a cinema, who were introduced to Fred Rogers in part heart through this film. Well, I can only talk to my experience and say it was an utter delight to meet him this way, and it sent me down a YouTube rabbit hole that's had me in tears and with lots of goosebumps ever since. In terms of the award side of things, well, things would peter out a little bit there, which was a little bit of a surprise in the end, that Tom Hanks would get a Best Supporting Actor Oscar nomination, but the rest of the film just got nothing. It just got that one award nomination. It picked up various bits and bobs, nomination-wise, around other awards organisations and other award ceremonies, but this isn't one that would be labelled with a huge number one box office hit on its DVD box. The poster wouldn't say winner of 70 million Academy Awards or anything like that. In fact, this was the year, it found itself up the year that Parasite won the Best Picture Oscar. Tom Hanks would miss out Best Supporting Actor to Brad Pitt for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. However, it was one of those films that, as it turned out, was a near 10-year journey to bring to the screen, a film that will continue to endure, I would suggest. And it, I don't know about you, it's a kind of film, if I'm having a low moment, it's certainly one of those that I reach for. But it goes back to the point I made just before. It's a film that appeared to do Fred Rogers proud. And that, going into this, that must have been no mean feat. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. Thank you, as always, for listening, and thank you for your time, and thank you for coming back after my summer break as well. I always worry people won't. If I don't bore you completely here, you can find more of me on Twitter at Simon Brew. You can find more from the entire Film Stories project on Twitter at Film Stories Pod. You can come and see me live at the London Podcast Festival on Thursday, the 15th of September as well. That's 2022, depending on when you're listening to this podcast. You can find more on that at the Film Stories website, which is filmstories.co.uk. That website also has movie news, reviews, features, all sorts of things that we do there. store.filmstories.co.uk is where you can buy back issues of all of our magazines and our sneakers Blu-ray, which we added fresh extras to as well. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, youtube.com/filmstories, and the Patreon is patreon.com/simonbrew. But without further ado, I'm going to go off and watch another bunch of films. The most important thing, as always, is you stay safe and you stay well. I'll be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Until then, you all look after yourselves. Good to be back. Take care. Bye-bye.